Just by the way, if anybody needs an eye shade, you're most welcome to just take one. I've got plenty more in my office. And I know that in the US, they're actually called iPads. So I was very naughty, Mark. I asked one of the younger monks, oh, do you need a new iPad? I said, really? So what model is it? And I said, oh, it's just a really, you know, high quality. Really? Okay. And I go, so these are iPads in US. But they're very good for putting over your eyes if you need just to, you get bothered by too much light, or you wondered whether if you are getting into deep meditations, and is this an imitator or is it just imagining all one of these lights over here? Then you find out. Even sometimes if, well, there's not much light here in this compound, but if you do get bothered by, you know, excess light when you're trying to get to sleep, these are very helpful. So I think we need a few more people, first of all. I think they're still cleaning up and doing stuff, so I'll just wait for a few more moments. At least it seems, oh yeah, some more people coming in. That probably looks a bit like most people are in. Okay, so what I'm going to begin with is, you know, last night there's one question that was hiding in the box. So I just had a quick look at it this morning. I thought this is a nice question to actually begin this morning's talk. And it was, other than happiness and peace that can be achieved through meditation, what is the ultimate purpose or benefit of meditation? Why do we need to meditate? And this starts to tie in. Oh, there's quite a few more people out there. Oh, this is from Bodhinyana Monastery coming up. Very good. So what is the ultimate purpose and benefit of meditation? And that was a question which was asked so many years ago of my teacher Ajahn Chah. And what the story was, that this must have been about, oh, at least 40 years ago, when meditation was beginning to appear as an important tool for both spirituality, for medicine, and so many other benefits, that many advanced countries in the West wanted to find out, you know, about meditation. And so the country of Sweden, the government wanted to, they initiated some research on meditation. And they chose a professor, a very eminent professor in one of the universities in Sweden, and they sent him, paid all his expenses, sent him to the Southeast Asia, South Asia, East Asia, to interview as many experts on meditation as he could find. People with good reputations of really knowing what they're talking about. Not professors like him, but people who actually did the meditation. And because he wanted to do a study, he had to ask everybody the same questions. to standardize the results. So eventually he found his way up to Ajahn Chah in northeast Thailand. And I was fortunate enough to be there when this Swedish professor came to ask the questions of Ajahn Chah. And so this was a representative of the Swedish government. So, you know, you had to treat him with the dignity which he deserved. And so that having welcomed him and just to make sure he was comfortable, then the professor asked, through a translator, who translated into Thai, saying he'd been commissioned by the Royal Swedish government to come to this place to ask these series of questions on meditation for his study. And now he wished to ask Ajahn Chah these questions. And there were four of them, just four of them. And the questions were, and it was through the translator that Ajahn Chah heard them in Thai. But the professor spoke in English, so you heard them directly. The first question is, what is meditation? And the second question is, why do you meditate? And third, how do you meditate? What's the method? And lastly, what do you get out of meditation? And it was that last question which reminded me of this person here. What's the ultimate benefit of meditation? And when those questions were asked of Ajahn Chah, then Ajahn Chah, he asked for a piece of paper and a pencil, which he never does. It's the only time in my life I've seen him ask for a piece of paper and a pencil, which was code for everybody who knew that great monk that we're about to see something very memorable and funny. He had a great sense of humor, as you will soon find out. But the sense of humor was always very meaningful. It was probing and deep. It had a great purpose to it. But that's why it's very wonderful to be around. Light-hearted, deep. And my goodness, when he started doing something a little bit weird, you know, you were saying, this is going to be good. I wonder what's going to happen now. And so he got the piece of paper, and they asked for the question to be repeated, slowly. And then, the next thing, he scratched his head. And then he wrote something down. He was just playing around. He wrote something down. And then afterwards, when he finished his fourth question, he gave it to the translator. And the translator had to stop laughing before he could translate it into English for the professor. And Ajahn Chah said, through the translator, Professor, the answer to your first question, what is meditation? The great master Ajahn Chah, revered in this part of the world, his answer is, what is eating? The answer to your second question is, why do you meditate? His answer is, why do you eat? And at this point, the professor was getting a bit disappointed. And the third, the answer to the third question, how do you meditate? How do you eat? And the fourth question, what do you get out of meditating? His answer is, what do you get out of eating? At which point the professor got quite angry. He said, look, this isn't a joke. This comes from the Royal Government of Sweden. I can't take that back to my government. And Ajahn Chah said, well, that's all I'm giving you. And it wasn't a joke. It was a powerful, deep answer. Now, first of all, what is meditation? What is eating? What is eating? It's something which is so natural. You never ask a question of what is eating. Maybe you can study in biology, but even a child, a baby, knows what eating is. And just why you eat. And how do you eat? Yes, we've got manners and stuff, but you know, there's a natural ability, a natural knowledge of how to eat and when to eat. It's something which is ingrained in you. It's obvious. But when we start making a philosophy about it, then it all gets complicated, when it should be something which is as natural as breathing, which is also meditating, isn't it? Interesting. But anyway, and then what do you get out of meditating? What do you get out of eating? And you can obviously understand that you eat to have a healthy body. And it's not just for health in its own sake. It's a healthy body so you can serve and do your duties in this world to help others, to create a better world, to solve any problems which have come up from time to time. To give and serve. So eating or meditating, just like eating is food for the body, meditation becomes food for the mind, food for the heart if you like. And if you only have junk food for your body, you get sick. If you only have junk food for your heart, for your mind, otherwise known as Game of Thrones, Avengers, or football, or politics, but worrying about politics. Some of that is like food, is junk food. Does that really make you happy and get you sort of energized and beautiful and powerful so you can serve in this world? So, it's health food for the mind. It's meditation, if you know how to do it properly. And of course, how do you meditate? My job as a teacher is actually more to point out what not to do when you meditate. It's not what to do, because what to do is actually quite natural. To get out of the way of striving, of trying to achieve things, of trying to get somewhere, of thinking you can't do it, and putting all these obstacles in the path of what should be such a natural process. So my job is actually to, as a teacher, to stop this, don't do that, don't do this, and see what happens when all those obstacles disappear and meditation happens beautifully, easily. And so that's how you meditate and why you meditate. My goodness, that was the most wonderful thing I've stumbled across, to learn how to meditate. And again, I haven't got a photographic memory, but of course in your life is such many important events in your life. And one of those important events for me was, it was in the Wordsworth room of King's College, Cambridge, because that was the first meditation class I ever attended. And it would have been in 1969, in the maybe November, December, 69. I went to learn some meditation, not knowing what I was supposed to be doing, but just sitting down, it was only 5 minutes, and feeling some peace. Not much peace, but it was enough, a taste. Wow, this is really good. And, that just hooked me straight away. And it's hooked me and stayed with me for the last almost 50 years now. It's 50 years, isn't it, 69? So, all those years, ever since that first little taste of peace, and recognizing that this was important. So that's why I meditate. There's something attractive about it. And all the benefits of meditation, they keep on getting researched here, researched there. Of course, the main benefit of meditation is it does lead to freedom, to the end of suffering. And through wisdom, not through sort of dulling out, but understanding the nature of this body and this mind and this world, learning how to be free. And one of the similes which comes to mind, because I don't plan a talk, very rarely do I plan anything. That's why sometimes you get into trouble. I should have been somewhere else today. I should have rang somebody else, but anyway, it all works out. But this particular simile which comes to mind also happened in 1969, in the summer. This was a few months before I started meditating. Because I did Now, in that particular system, I was a smart kid at school, and I did my A-levels when I was only 16. And then you did entrance exams at Cambridge, and so I couldn't go up there until I turned 18. So I had almost 9 months or 10 months of freedom. Now, I had all these studies were complete, nothing to do, and so I decided to get a little job. And I'm going to go on these tangents because this is a really fascinating story about guilt. One of the jobs I got, I was a poor student, and you want any little job you can find, just to get a bit of money to get enough to go overseas, and what they call these days a gap year. And so my father was dead, my mother didn't have any money, so I had to try and find a job and do it myself. And so I got a job as a door-to-door encyclopedia salesman. The worst possible sales job you could ever get. And I only lasted about 3 or 4 days. And because what happened, it was like children's encyclopedias. And, it was just, I had a quick look, it was rubbish. But you had this little sales pitch you had to give. And basically, when you knocked on the door, if somebody had children there, you had to make them feel that they were just depriving their children of an education if they didn't buy these amazing books, that they would be behind everybody else if you didn't sort of buy these books which everybody else had. In fact, it was almost like they were just a paedophile, please excuse me, if they didn't buy these books, because they were really abusing and not helping their children. So it was a terrible little spiel, but I learned it, and you know what happened one day? I sold a book. It was actually an encyclopedia. Actually, it worked. I sold a book. And I felt so terrible about it afterwards. The next day I resigned. And I felt, I sold this rubbish book, series of books, to this family who had just had a young child, maybe about 2 or 3 years of age. And I just, money was hard to come by, and I don't know how they could scrape together the money to pay for this encyclopedia, but there it was. And I was responsible for that. That's why I resigned the next day. And I told that story about feeling so guilty in selling something I didn't really believe in, because I needed the money, and saying things which I really shouldn't have said to these poor parents. And I told that story years later in the Anulamara temple here in Perth. And I said, I forgave myself a long time ago. I was just a young kid trying to do what I thought was the worthwhile. And you know what happened? After my talk, this woman came up. She was about 10 or 15 years younger than I was. And she said, I have to say this to you, but I remember one of my earliest memories was of this young student coming to our door. And he had really long curly hair, which I did have at those days. And he sold my parents this children's encyclopedia. And I just, couldn't have been me. And she said, I love that book. It was my favorite book of all time. I slept with it, I read it, and I just sat, and I thought, at first you think, no, it can't be you. But then, looked at the times, the dates, the place, and quite likely it was me. Somebody was coming up to tell me that what I felt really guilty about actually help somebody. And they said, thank you so much for selling my parents that book. What do you feel guilty about? Maybe if you find a person you sort of thought you upset. Sometimes you don't know just how life turns around and what you did was wonderful. Weird, isn't it? And why it is that with all the people, selling these books was over in north of London somewhere, and meeting one another in just in Perth so many years later, and she happened to listen to my talk when I said that. It was really quite spooky. But those sorts of things tend to happen in our life. So anyway, there I was. So when I went over to the United States, it was pretty boring over there, I must admit, same as any other place. So I went to Central America, because I always saw these pyramids in the jungles. And I thought that was really fascinating, because no one knew about that civilization, exactly what they did there. This is not the Aztecs, this was the Mayan civilization, which actually disappeared, you know, off that face of that Guatemala, Mexico, the Yucatan Peninsula. It was before the Mexican conquistadors came. And no one knows why they vanished. But they left these enormous pyramids in the jungle. So I thought it would be really cool to go and visit one of these. But it wasn't easy to get there. You know, I managed to get to the capital of Guatemala, Guatemala City, and then had to get a bus, you know, from the city to the coast. And even halfway on that journey, the bus was stopped by the military. Every male had to come out. The machine guns were trained on you, because there was no revolution in that part of the world all the time, it seems. And they checked your passports. Unfortunately, they didn't think I was CIA or MI6 or anything, so they took me back on the bus and so carried on. Interesting times. But amazing. I was never scared. I think it was more stupidity. Because I thought, oh, you know, I'm safe, nothing will harm me. But anyway, then, from the port and over, you know, a midnight, got on a fishing boat and up the coast of the Caribbean to the border between Guatemala and what was then British Honduras, Belize. And that was the first time when I was so tired, been up all night, but then to see the sunrise over the Caribbean. It was just so breathtaking, I just could not go to sleep. It taught me one thing, that when it's very joyful and happy, it just abolishes tiredness. Because it's the joy actually feeds energy into the mind. And the opposite, of course, when you're depressed, I've heard this story before, can't we do something else, can we have something else for breakfast, that takes energy from your mind. And you just, you know, you want to go to sleep, you're just half asleep anyway. But some beauty, something which is breathtakingly gorgeous, that actually energizes the mind and makes you really, really bright. So anyway, after that, up of this river, and this was basic. You see these indigenous people going along in their dugout canoes, all naked, and any moment, I honestly expected Tarzan to come swinging out of the jungle, out of the rainforest. That's what it looked like. And he went then over to the back of trucks. There was no public transport. Now, the reason I say that, what happened, was because about 3 days, I'd been traveling on boats, you know, up the rivers, and on the back of trucks, single dirt tracks through the jungle. And it's something I never realized until later. If you travel in the jungle, in those old days, single tracks, you are traveling through tunnels. Tunnels of green. Because even if you clear a path, those rainforests are just so alive that soon, a day or two later, the branches cover it over. And even the rivers were tunnels. And it's an important part of the story. For days, I hadn't seen the horizon. I hadn't even seen the sky. All I ever saw was greenery above, below, to the left, to the right, all over. I go through a tunnel. But then eventually, you got to this site called Tikal, in the middle of the Yucatan Peninsula. There was a sort of airstrip there, but there's no other way of getting to that place, and so there was no one around except one archaeologist, and he was busy doing his stuff. I understand how people who have got no ethics can very easily steal all sorts of valuable stuff, because there's no one to stop you, it's just open. But anyway, I wasn't into stealing anything. If I did steal anything anyway, how could I carry it back? You know. But anyway, what I did do, I saw these huge pyramids and no one was stopping you. There's no signs or anything. So I decided to climb one of them, to climb to the top, see what's there. And just to say, why do we meditate? Why do boys climb things? I don't know, it's a boy thing. What was that great saying of the one of those, no, not Hillary, it was, anyway, he was one of the people who climbed up Mount Everest. And they asked him, what did you do that for? Why did you climb up Mount Everest? And his answer was very profound. He said, because it's there. That was actually a deep psychology there. Why do you climb that huge mountain? Because it's there. And that certainly was why I climbed up one of those pyramids. It's not quite as high as Mount Everest, but really it's a long way up. And when I got up to the top, it was worth it. Because, you know, without doing any research about what professors thought those pyramids were there for, it was very clear to me, having no knowledge, why they had those pyramids. I've seen already, I think, some of the sayings which I've said over the years, and in particular, you see them on t-shirts sometimes. And I think it was Three had it on the back of one of the t-shirts. Never let your knowledge stand in the way of truth. Because all your knowledge, what's supposed to be up there, why they did that, but if you don't have that knowledge and put all that knowledge, all that learning aside, then the truth is quite clear to you. And for going up on top of that pyramid, the truth, which was appeared to me so clearly, was number one, the wind could go at the top of that pyramid, because the top of the pyramid was just above the tree line of the jungle. It was higher than the highest of trees. So if you've ever been in a jungle or in a rainforest, it's sweaty, I think I have a word in English called close. There's no wind, because the air's got no place to go. And it's hot, it's steamy, mosquitoes, but you go above the forest, and it's really good air, just actually winds just blowing and cooling you. It's like going up into an aircon. So number one, it was just so cool and fresh on top of the pyramid. And number two, when I looked down, you could see, it was the days before we ever had Google Maps, you could actually see where you came from. And it was quite amazing that it took all day to come maybe about 3 or 4 miles, because of, you know, the difficult terrain. But you could actually see it on top. You could see which way you came, where you crossed the river, where the rivers were. You could even see the village where you stayed the night before. It didn't look all that far away when you're on top of the pyramid. You had your whole world spread out in front of you. You knew where you came from and how all those villages, paths and rivers all fat together. And the best was when I stopped looking down at where I'd come from and stopped looking at the jungle, but just looked. Remember, for 3 days I could not see horizons, could not see the sky, I was going through tunnels. For the first time in 3 days I could see far distances. You could see infinity in all directions with nothing between you and the infinite. That was so cool. Sometimes meditation, religion, Buddhism, Dhamma, sometimes we put things in between us and ultimate reality, whatever you want to call it. But imagine everything between you and infinity is taken away. There's nothing. Nothing at all. I haven't told a joke for a little while, so sometimes I'm a very naughty, cheeky monk. So this was one of my friends here who was, is a Christian, but very sort of open. And I was going overseas to give some talks, and we had a little chat before I left. And he decided just to be cheeky to me. So, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, you have to admit, all the years I've known you, you have to admit that nothing is higher than God. I looked at him and said, yes, I agree with you. Yeah, nothing is higher than God. And he thought, wow, have I converted Ajahn Brahm? And then I repeated, yeah, nothing, emptiness, is much higher than any God. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you're just incorrigible. So anyway, you can understand what I meant there. When you had this beautiful space all around. So, what's the meaning of those pyramids? You don't know what the meaning is until you climb one and experience what it's like to be on the top. And to almost imagine what it must have been like for these young village boys and girls when they got to some age and they thought that now was the time for them to go up to that pyramid for the first time, to be taken up by an elder. And I'd only been in the jungle for 3 or 4 days, and it literally really shocked me, just the distances and the purity of the air and just how peaceful it was up there. And imagine you've lived all your life in those villages, always down in the bottom, then they take you up the top of this pyramid. Number one, you can see, that's your village over there, that's where your grandma lives, that's actually the path between which goes all over, that is the main sort of market town where maybe your father goes to sell corn or coffee beans. So you could see everything. It's like the whole world was mapped out. The why you have to go to work and have babies and have relationships, and why that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, and how to fix it all up, and how to find some peace in this world, how to live together, and why you do these things. You can see the whole thing mapped out on top of that pyramid. And you feel so peaceful and cool up there. And for the space, it's not the space, the infinity, the peace, which separates people. It's actually just what connects all those villages, all those trees and rivers and mountains, all embraced by this beautiful emptiness, which no one can draw on, no one can capture, no one can take out a patent on. Free, empty, beautiful, cool. A place, because it's so free and empty, that nothing blocks you from seeing. All those little images and ways of looking just were so strong up there. So I never knew what the ultimate meaning of those pyramids were, until I climbed one with an open mind. A mind which was naive, because it hadn't been told what to expect. And that's to say with meditation, it's climbing a pyramid in your mind, leaving the world. Because the world which we live in, even I go over to Bodhidharma Monastery and just do some work, or go into that my office and the computer and all this other stuff, it is like a jungle, the tangle of all your responsibilities and duties, your family, monks and nuns and appointments and stuff. It's a tangle, it's like a forest. But every now and again, you can leave the jungle. And it's not, being a monk ordaining is not leaving the jungle forever. I'd be great if that was the case, if I can get up a pyramid and stay up there. But what happens is people actually shout up, Ajahn Brahm, can you come down for a few minutes? We need your help. So of course, you help out. But it's, you know how to get up your pyramid any time. So that's where you can learn how to let go of the jungle of the creepy creepers and the vicious vines and the terrible trees and all this other stuff which lingers in the forests and jungles. You can leave it. You know the way up. And you go into this lovely meditation path. Why the breath? The reason for the breath is you're letting go of your body, you know, all of your sight, smell, sorry, hearing, taste and touch. But it's so difficult to let go of the body. It's like you let go of all the body except the breath, and then you let go of the breath to actually get into the mind. It's like a stepping stone across a river. You know, you can watch the breath. The breath is calm and peaceful. And the breath actually changes as you get more peaceful. It starts off, it's quite coarse, but as you relax, 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 because you are not, sorry, relax to the max, relax to the max, relax to the max. It does mean you're not doing so much, which means your metabolism goes down, which means your breath gets more refined. Your breath adapts as you get more and more peaceful. So it actually starts in a coarse breath, but then it gets smoother and smoother and smoother until it takes you into a very calm state, and then you can let go of the breath as you step over into the realm of the mind. So that's one of the reasons we have the breathing, because it's a natural way, and it's just how we just step up. Even the pyramids are made of rocks which come from the ground, you know, from the jungle. But you use those rocks that are similar to the breath in order to climb up to transcend the rocks and the jungles. So you get above it all, to leave it for a while. And it's so true that when you get into even that stage of meditation, just even watching the breath, and it gets very peaceful, it is like a breath of fresh air. And I can breathe, you're free again, and all these questions and problems and having to do stuff and think about things and all of that is just gone, just for a few minutes. And that means you can get perspective. And why you come on a meditation retreat? No one forced you. You're not sent here, and it's not part of your bucket list to do before you die. It's that you find that it's something which, when you come here, you just see how your life fits together. Why you have to do what you have to do, and why things happen in life. And what I was saying, that sometimes in life, things go wrong, it's like a test for you. And often, as if life knows that you're up for this test. You might not think you're up for it, but you are. It's like when people get cancers. You know, they'd rather not have that. They'd rather take a nice easy life. But it's a test for you. And it's amazing how many people rise to the occasion. And they pass the test. It's a tough test, but they say, and they'd said this to me, hundreds of people. It was the best thing that ever happened to them. When I first heard that, I was shocking. You just had some mastectomy. You've had chemotherapy for a year, and you say it's the best thing which ever happened to you. You say it wasn't pleasant. It was scary. But they learned so much from it. They grew so much. They realize that part of the meaning of the life is not to be comfortable, but is to grow, to learn kindness, to learn just the importance of these moments, and not to waste things, thinking that life will go on like this forever. You learn so much. So because of that, you learn how things work together, the tests which you have in life, because you can see all of that sort of planned around you. And of course, up the top there, you do get refreshed. And the ultimate questions on life. And the infinity in all directions. And just how you can just stay there. You can't write on the sky. You cannot think in silence. All those words which you can hear in your mind right now. It's like writing words on the sky. There's nothing to pin them on. So in a great silence, space, emptiness, you can't have a thought. Thoughts have got nothing to hang on. And so, there is peace. Peace and deep, deep stillness. And the realization. The realization, not something you think, something you know, is that all those questions, you get an answer to them, and they just make more questions, which make more answers, which make more questions. And that path goes on and on and on, round and round. It's one of the meanings of the word samsara, perpetual wandering. And I just changed the A to an O, perpetual wandering. Wander about this and wander about that. But then there comes a time when you do find some stillness and peace. When you're up that pyramid, just looking, there's not a thought comes up in your mind. You don't need thoughts anymore. You're way beyond describing stuff. You're peaceful. And you start to realize all those thoughts, searching for answers, that stops you finding the answers. Just meditating, stilling the mind. I don't mean believing what other people say. You don't, there's no one else up that pyramid, only you. And it's not sort of getting the meaning of life as something you can take down like some Ten Commandments which Moses is supposed to have taken down from Sinai. They get shattered. Because this is not a theory. It's a meaning, a peace. I say peace, meaning, bliss, freedom. Whereas other people might use another word for it, you know, which is L-O-V-E, love. Interesting. That coming together of stillness, peace, bliss, and compassion. And these are not separate things. It was the case that when thank you, my dad, my father, for initiating that, philosophy or that path of opening the door of your heart unconditionally, no matter what's happening. To me, that was where peace and love come together. You open the door of your heart, you're making peace with things. You're not being selective. You're not saying, you're not being discriminating. You can come into my country, but you can't because you're the wrong race. You can come into my house because you're my friend, not you because you're my ex. I can do business with you, but I can't do business with you. Okay, people say, that's practical, yeah, I'm not sure about that, but nevertheless, imagine having an open heart. The door of my heart's open, and anybody can be my friend. Imagine that. That's not only love, really unconditional love. The Buddha said, just like the sun shines on all people, doesn't matter what race, what religion, whether you're in a prison or whether you are in a monastery, or in the top of the mountain or underground, or actually not underground, I suppose the sun sort of shines underground, but you know, with electric lights or something, because it just goes a bit of a delay. Just making it up as I go along, because I realise what I said, underground there's no sun, but anyway, I suppose you can transport sun underground. So, in the wonderful loving kindness, state of peace and stillness and meaning, deep meaning. So, how do we find that meaning? The meaning of life. So, the only way to find that is you climb your pyramid, which is a metaphor for meditating. And, oh, okay. I was going to talk about... No time for that. Anyway, just to be able to find that, it's not pyramid going up, it's the pyramid inside, going in, and in and in and in. When I was talking about the jhanas yesterday, people say, oh, that's too much for me. No. In a very profound way, every one of you has the jhanas. They're right inside now, but you just need to open it up like peeling the onion. But in this particular simile, it was actually peeling the lotus flower. I think I've got time enough to start the lotus flower simile. And lotus, there's one over there. It's not real, well, not real ones, but good enough. A lotus flower at night time is closed up. And if any of you have a look at a lotus pond and see one of those lotus flowers which is all closed up, hasn't opened yet, the sun hasn't come out, you have a look at that, sniff it, no fragrance at all. Look at it, outermost leaves, they're like corrugated. And that's not sort of beautiful or profound or delicate. And you look at it, this is, are you trying to tell me there's a beautiful flower inside of that sheath? And of course there is. Ajahn Brahm, are you trying to tell me there's this beautiful enlightenment and jhanas and right inside of you? Open it up. See what's inside, deep inside of you. And that's why that you go to prisons and you see these mass murderers. Beautiful, beautiful fragrant hearts inside of that. You just need to have the courage to actually open out. See what's inside. And anyway, you know what happens when the light comes up in the morning, the sun comes up. There are two things open up a lotus. Not just the light, but the warmth as well. The light and warmth of the sun. Standing for mindfulness and kindness working together. The light and the warmth. And as the light and warmth of the sun hits the outermost sheath of the lotus, it opens up. Slowly. So the light and warmth can hit the next layer. So that opens up. So it can hit the next layer. So that opens up. They open up layer by layer by layer. And the next layer is right inside the layer which you're looking at right now. And that's what we do in meditation. That's how we climb the pyramid. That is the pyramid. We look upon this stupid old body and mind. Fat, old, robes falling off. I look at that with kindness, with awareness. And your body relaxes, you open up, you go inside. Only when you're kind and aware, the body relaxes, it's not a problem anymore, then you go to the emotional world, the world of the mind. And, first of all, that world of the mind, there's so much stuff going on there. And especially time. There's all the past, all the future, the present, all those things which are waiting for you when this retreat finishes, all the stuff you left behind, you wonder, should I sort of get an email and check it all out, what should I do? A whole heap of time. What do? You're aware and kind. Let the light of mindfulness and the sun of kindness warm that. And you go inside. Inside of time. As I say, being kind to the past, kind to the future, and aware of it, it opens up. You go to the center of it, otherwise known as the present moment, just now. It just happens automatically. When you're relaxing and peaceful, it's quite nice being here. Come and join me. And you go into the present moment. And then, with the present moment, it gets so profound, it opens up. And you go into silence. The silence is right inside the present moment. This little point which is so in this moment. There's no past, there's no future, there's no place to say anything. The thought has got no space to show itself. You're silent. And already that's really fragrant, beautiful petals of you, the lotus inside. The silence is right inside this moment. And this moment is right inside time, and this time is right inside your mind, which is right inside your body, which is right inside this hall. And you go deep into the silence, and then just in the silence, that's where you start to experience your breathing, one of the only things left. When I meditate, I don't go looking for my breath. I just sit here and relax, let go, and all the lotus petals, they just open up and you're soon into the breath. And then you watch your breath, that's pretty nice, pretty neat and wonderful. And then that opens up until it becomes the whole of the breath. Beginning to end, it happens naturally. And that opens up and it becomes a delightful breath. And that delightful breath, a gorgeous set of petals on the lotus. So fragrant. And then that opens up. And then that opens up, that's a beautiful light, sanimitas, and they're really gorgeous. And now you're flying. I wonder what else is inside this lotus, my body and mind, all this being I've been living with all these years. And you're going up the pyramid, you're really seeing a lot of interesting stuff going on. And then that opens up, and inside the nimittas is absolutely amazing lights, more bliss than you could ever think you could imagine. And that's actually true. I say these things because other people experience this. They think they can't, no human being can take so much bliss. You know what I found out? There's no limit to the bliss you can experience. And even some years ago, this fellow was trying to get off his heroin addiction over in Bodhidharma Monastery. Brave man, and just so sad when people get sort of addicted to heroin. Not everyone takes heroin and gets addicted, but when you do, that's it. He said 1,000 times a day he has to say no. One time he says yes and he's back in his addiction again. Such a terrible thing. But because he was meditating, and I thought I'd almost got him out of his addiction, because he came running towards me. One day I was going into the Nalamara temple and came running to it. Ajahn Brahm, I've got to tell you this. I said, what is it? And he said, I know I've heard you say many, many, many times that the bliss of meditation is better than sexual orgasm. And I said that, you know, because just telling it as it is. You know, as a young man, you know, I was not born as a monk, had my relationships and girlfriends. And I was actually very glad I did, because then you know what you're talking about. You know what you're leaving behind. I feel quite sad sometimes if a man or a woman ordains and they haven't had a relationship yet. They can fantasize and think, oh, and if I found the love of my life, then I'd be really happy and I'm missing out. But you know, you're fortunate, did all of that. So know what you're letting go of. But this guy said, yeah, I could accept that, but I never thought I'd ever be able to say that the bliss of meditation is better than heroin. He'd obviously really touched a very deep state of meditation. And one of the main reasons why people keep taking that terrible, terrible drug, the bliss, he found a bliss better than that in deep meditation. That's what we're talking about, it's huge. And weird it may sound that people are afraid of such powerful bliss. A lot of time because you're out of control. You can't control something that powerful. You have to let go. And the control freak inside of you says, no, 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 too much for me, too dangerous. I can't be in charge of this. It's like you've only been used to driving a bicycle and somebody gives you a Ferrari, but you're behind the wheel. That's a bit sort of scary for you. You may dream about, oh, yeah, that'd be great. If you're actually behind the wheel, ooh, this is too powerful. So there's a scary part there. But it's also the excitement. Yeah, because you know it's profound. You know it's really deep. And if ever you do some studies of Buddhism, fortunately, that it's only afterwards I really got into the studies. And there's one of the suttas there which really just goosebumped me up and down for days. And that was where I was in the Chulahati Padopama Sutta. It was the first sutta which the Arahat Mahinda taught when he went to Sri Lanka. And I often thought, why did, of all the teachers, why did he choose to teach this to the king, which he met when he first went to Sri Lanka? And it was the most important part of the sutta is, if you can have experience of those jhana states, it's no different than what the Buddha experienced. No difference at the time. Obviously, when you come out afterwards, in the part ways, as it were, your sort of experience fades away. Buddha's is solid. You experience what it's like to be a Buddha, deeply, profoundly, and even the bliss. They call it Sambodhisukha. This is just the first jhana, the bliss of enlightenment in the sutta. That's what it says. So, to tell people, and this is not a joke, that if ever you want to go and see the places where the Buddha lived, you don't have to get an airline ticket and go to India. You don't have to endure going out into the fields to urinate or defecate, or just experiencing the air, which is very, very unclean. If you really want to experience the places, the four holy places, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, they're the four holy places of Buddhism. Spiritual, mind-blowing, fantastic. And that's what happens, it's right inside the delightful breath, right inside the nimittas. You go in and in and in, you keep going in. That's how it works. And one of the great insights from this is when you realize that you go in. That's one of the reasons why you don't have to go anywhere. You don't ever have to go to the next stage of meditation. Don't give up what you have now to get to the next stage. Stay where you are. Even if you're sloth and torpor, even if you're fantasizing, whatever, I don't care, but stay. Go inside. In. Into where you are, and into that, and into that, into that. Zooming in. Remember like Google Earth? You get a picture of, say, Hong Kong, and then you Google in, and you Google in, and you go to, say, Kowloon, and then you go from Kowloon to something street, and you go to this street, and you always zoom, 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 zoom in. That's what you do with meditation, always zooming in. Go right to the center, and there you'll find jhana. There you'll find bliss, there you'll find what they say is the jewel in the heart of the lotus. You know what that word is in Sanskrit? Jewel in the heart of the lotus? Manipadme. Om and Hum are just like Namo. It's just like worship, hail, salute. The jewel in the heart of the lotus. Tibetans, they chant that so often. What does it mean? Have you seen the jewel in the heart of the lotus that is you? Have a look. Climb up that pyramid and see what's in there. You, little Buddhas, will be surprised. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. There we go. Anyway, so that's all you need to know. So, no need for any more talks or sutta classes or questions and answers. You have all the answers there. That's what it is. That's what happened. That's what the meaning, the ultimate purpose of meditation.